and start the show.
For Thursday, February 15th, 2018, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Ahoy hoy out there to Tested podcast listeners. You know, several things happened this week that made me realize there are a lot more listeners out there than I realize. One, and two, some of you out there are pretty cool people.
Yeah, I agree. It was terrifying.
And
Norm and I shared that moment together. We're like, oh no, people listen to this sometimes.
Yeah. And I want to apologize to you out there. Who are listening?
I'm never apologizing, never apologizing for the mayor.
Okay.
Never apologizing for the mayor.
What's the context here, guys?
We were just on a conference call, and like somebody's like, yeah, I listen to your show.
And I'm like, oh, you listen to Still Entitled, right? No, I listen to This Only a Test. What? Huh?
No.
Huh? All right. How you guys doing?
Good.
I am exhausted. I have been up since 3:30 in the morning.
Planning for Valentine's Day.
Not one bit. I am taking my wife out to dinner tonight, I watched the men's Olympic ice hockey game.
You got up for that?
I got up at, I watched the game at 4:10 in the morning. Wow. First USA game, red-blooded American, saw us fall to the great nation of Slovenia.
Wow, disappointing.
Disappointing doesn't begin to describe the dent in my wall from me like punching it as I watch this travesty.
The rest of the family's got to wake up somehow.
The only solace is that the Olympic athletes from Russia also lost, the favorite in the tournament. They lost to Slovakia.
Ooh, and Slovenia and Slovakia?
Basically setting up a USA-Russia game in a couple days that the loser goes home.
Double elimination. Wow. Way more exciting than Overwatch. Maybe. Debatable. Probably fewer people watching it. Who knows? Olympics are going on right now. We're going to talk a little about the technology and the watching habits for the Olympics. But I want to talk about a different type of sport. Different type of motorsport.
Okay.
I want to talk about some water sports.
Yeah, what kind?
Yeah.
Olympic? Olympic?
No, non-Olympic. Non-Olympic water sports. Our top story this week, riding on a boat.
Yeah, so you and I and Gunther,
producer Gunther,
We went over to Emeryville yesterday, and you know, we didn't know quite what to expect, but you guys, I guess Ryan had found online a video of a gentleman who has made his very own mini boat.
That's right. It's all over social media on Facebook, which Ryan's our official Facebook tracker, and he waved the flag and said, this thing could be cool. And I was so skeptical, but it was super cool. So, and it turns out the guy is local right in Emeryville. Josh is his name. He runs a website and company called Rapid Whale. And you may have seen this video pop up on YouTube or social media, but he designed and then built a one-person boat, like a single passenger, one of the smallest boats, motorized boats, in the world.
He actually, this is called a mini boat, and I don't even know if it deserves its own segment yet, because he says there are literally 4 mini boat designs ever created, and that this may be the 10th or 11th boat in existence.
In this category.
In the world.
6 feet long. Small boat.
So enough room for a person and nothing else?
No, nothing.
A person. But the videos, like, you can find these videos, and they're fun because he's wearing the captain's hat. He looks like he's having a lot of fun on the small boat in the water, which is novel, and it's cool that someone designed a boat. But it's really the what went into the design and the making of the boat ended up being far more interesting to us.
Because when you think of boat making, you think of carpentry.
Yes.
You know, labor and saws and sawdust.
Well, you have the visualization of a warehouse or on a dry dock where you have
sparks and nails.
And rigs and jigs. And he didn't do any of that. So Josh is a product designer, industrial designer, and in his workspace in Emeryville, he has 3D printers and he has a big laser cutter, 100-watt laser cutter. And this boat he designed in SolidWorks is made is made out of just cut sheets of quarter-inch ply.
like varnished together so it doesn't leak?
Varnished and fiberglass and epoxied. What we found so interesting, and we have a we'll have a video for this. We filmed the whole thing.
If you guys can't hear me shaking my head at the picture of Jeremy in this thing, is really comical. Really, the captain's hat and the life vest really set this off.
Yeah.
This is barely a step above an RC boat.
It's basically the Power Wheels, but for boats.
I called it a go-kart boat. Yeah, it's basically that.
And Danica, I look like a child.
Oh, yeah. No, you don't look sexy.
How did you feel?
I want to talk about the manufacturer of this because, like, really, you guys want to hear about the making of the boat before the riding in the boat, which we did. So there was no jig. There was no form that he then pressed the wood against. What he designed and built this out of was a mechanism called stitch and glue. So he learned it from kayak makers, and you could buy kayak kits. And basically, what that means is, as opposed to forming the wood around a compound curve, a complex surface, and then steaming it or heating it or getting it wet to adhere that surface, he is basically joining it with zip ties along like right angles or along its the hinges, and then epoxying those joints together. And just the mere fact of zip tying the plywood together around around its other pieces gets you the forms.
So he laser cuts holes for the zip ties. And he puts the zip ties through, he pulls everything together, lays epoxy down, and he's got a boat, essentially.
That's enough tension from zip ties.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the epoxy seals it.
For the epoxy to set.
The epoxy seals it.
I mean, really,
well.
You just need enough time for the epoxy to set.
And he's got this long-form epoxy. He's got an hour or so for it, and he's painting it on. He used a gallon of epoxy to cover his entire boat.
Was it like a million zip ties, though?
In about two coats.
Not even a couple hundred zip ties.
There was one really severe curve along the bottom of the front.
The front, yeah,
where
yeah.
Where he did what laser cutters know.
Where it's cutting through the water, right?
Yes, yeah. The front of the boat, yeah.
And he used what they call a living hinge. We've seen this with other laser cuts, you know, where it's much smaller, but he did it on a big scale so that he actually has this nice curvature.
And that's when you cut in like a zigzag pattern along the wood so you can bend it. Using the kerf to take away the material, and that was sufficient enough to, one, get the form of the boat, and then, two, he then, you know, laid it up with fiberglass, put a couple epoxy coats on top of that, did some varnish, and then an offboard motor system, that 2 horsepower,
yeah,
and a steering system that's basically a laser cut steering wheel that's attached to 2 strands of rope that are tied to the motor. Along the shaft of the motor, a wheel on the shaft of the motor, and that provided
that changes the rudder.
There's no you actually turn the motor.
You turn the whole motor.
Yeah, you rotate the whole thing.
And there was so we took it out to the water. The whole thing fit in the back of his Prius, by the way.
Runs on 2 12-volt batteries.
Mm-hmm. 2 car batteries. Yep. Took it on the water. And it was the most fun thing ever.
It goes 4 miles an hour, but I'm telling you, man, it was really fun.
It's so fun.
It handles like crazy. It's like you can do 180s.
Yeah.
Wait, did you go in like a calm, like secluded water area? You weren't like in the bay.
No. It was a closed-off aquatic park.
That would be crazy.
Man-made, like, you know, 4 feet deep. Wasn't deep at all. Lots of seaweed.
A kayaker was in there with us.
Yeah. And
what kind of look did the kayaker give you as you flew by?
Everyone wanted to know about this thing.
Yeah.
And by the way, the kayaker was faster than the boat.
Much
faster. I'm sure. 4 miles an hour is basically slower than walking.
Mm-hmm. He's built 3 of them. So he's built one, his friend has built one, and his dad has built one. And he's offering them as kits. The kits don't include the motor or off-the-shelf parts like the seat. But
did he put up the plans?
You can buy the plans as well. One of the interesting things that we learned was that in prototyping it, designing a boat is not just like designing like a go-kart. You have to compensate for center of gravity, center of mass, like the buoyancy and everything. And all of that, all those properties can be built in the CAD, in the SolidWorks. But he had no idea whether it was actually work until he built it. So he built a half-scale model first because they make half-scale zip ties.
He scaled based on the smaller zip ties.
You put like a dog in this one?
No, I guess you could. Yeah, you could. And the half scale one, you know, he used 1/4-inch ply for the full scale, and then he could just use 1/8-inch ply.
And he took it to his friend's hot tub and turned the jets on and tested the buoyancy.
Because you get turbulence.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It was such a charming experience.
Is this turning
so
into
fun.
A video on the site?
Oh yeah, you guys will probably see it next week, if not like maybe 1 week after. But that was how we spent yesterday morning, and it was like smiles on our faces the whole day after that. All right, so let's talk about the Olympics. You guys, I know you're watching the Olympics, Kishore, hockey, any other sports? Jeremy, you watching Olympics at home?
Well, it's usually the only time we watch TV. Like, we have an antenna on the house that gets great HD reception, mm-hmm. and we only put that up there for, you know, once every 2 years.
I remember in San Francisco, like 10 years ago, it was quite controversial because NBC has had the rights to the Olympics a long time.
Yeah.
Over-the-air broadcasts for NBC went from San Francisco to San Jose. So people in San Francisco actually did not get the Olympics circa like 2000.
Over
or
the
something.
Air.
Yeah, over the air. But so you actually watch it over the air. You watch it at the set time where they have...
well, it's not real time.
I know. It's delayed and they pre-record all the segments. And they show you the biggest highlights and they edit for American audiences. You are not taking advantage of what technology has to offer. The live tweeting, the live streams on all the apps.
No. The technology I want is to turn off the commentators. Like, that's the only button.
It's called a mute button.
No, I want the sound. I want to be there, but I'd hate hearing the scripted commentating.
So what's interesting, if you watch the streaming, you get different commentators than the NBC one. So it's not all, like, red, white, and blue everything where they just talk about U.S. athletes. But that's hit or miss. Like, there's a British commentator for hockey who's using, like, very proper etiquette to talk about hockey with the breakout pass. And, he walloped a googly there. No, but it's a lot better getting the international broadcasters because usually there's somebody there that knows stuff. I like it because this is the 1 week a year I pretend to like curling.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone says they like curling. Have you seen those GIFs and those memes?
No one actually likes curling.
Really?
No, have you watched a full curling match? It's like an hour and a half of watching bocce ball.
Yeah.
I think curling's overrated.
What is the most exciting winter sport?
My kid likes biathlon the best because when they are like skiing as fast as they can, mm-hmm. cross country, and then they have to shoot these five targets, he like goes nuts when they miss. He's like, they missed. It's like one of the craziest things and like accounting for the wind. I think that's the one that he likes the most. I like speed skating.
Yeah, we could do a biathlon simulation in with like a boosted board and Nerf gun, right? Yes. Boosted board across the city, and then have to shoot Nerf at targets throughout.
Let's make this happen,
right?
Yeah,
that would be just as thrilling. Get those GoPros on there.
We need to really make some high quality Nerf rifles.
Well, I'm sure we can figure that out.
I actually have not been watching as much as my wife has. She's been very dedicated, but. I got an update on my phone yesterday. It said Shaun White took another gold.
Isn't he like 40 years old?
I know. I couldn't believe he was competing again.
Yeah.
Another gold.
Right, right.
Wow.
Snowboarder Chloe Kim is doing very well and is the star of the snowboarding scene this year.
She tweeted from the top of the hill.
That's the modern day Olympics. Absolutely. Now, in terms of the technology of the Olympics, did either of you watch the drone show that Intel put on?
I did watch the drone show, and you guys talked about it yesterday on Still Entitled, and it's incredibly impressive. We saw the same technology used at CES with the drone show above the Bellagio fountains, but there's one key facet you missed.
Mm.
That wasn't live.
It wasn't live. It was
like pre-recorded.
Much of the Olympics in the opening ceremony, like in past Olympics too, are kind of pre-recorded because they can't orchestrate these things, and they do rehearsals, and you know, people just have to realize that what you get in that NBC broadcast is not the real thing.
Well, no, but it goes beyond that. Go ahead.
The opening ceremonies had augmented reality effects that weren't even, like, nobody saw them.
They weren't actually there.
They were only for the television.
So it wasn't even, like, on the TV screens they had.
Well, maybe they were on TV screens, but, like, nobody saw them in person.
They had to react to them. All right, all right.
Yeah, right.
All right, guys. The big stadium. Cheer now as if you're imagining 100 drones making the Olympics rings.
Right. And beyond that, making like shapes of athletes and yeah, of different that, yeah. sports and everything else.
We've seen this before. At other events, they've had to do this exact same thing.
Yeah, and I still haven't gotten a reason why they canceled it. I'm sort of assuming it's because of wind or something, but they only told them moments before that the whole thing was off.
Mm. Interesting. And there are, I read there are some live drone performances throughout the Olympics, but there are fewer. It's not as many as they had during.
Is it because it's too cold?
I think it's just more controllable for live performances. It's easier to get, you know, 50 of them to perform together than it is to get several hundred.
Hmm. I mean, they didn't say that it had anything to do with this hack that happened, did they?
No, tell me about the hack, though.
Well, apparently, and I wasn't even aware of this because I was watching live TV, but I don't know, if you guys were streaming, did you have your stream go down during the opening ceremonies?
No, I didn't watch the live stream.
Well, apparently there was a big cyber attack that had been in the works since December against the opening ceremonies at the Olympics. These cyber attacks, according to New York Times, that took out the internet access and telecast, grounded broadcasters' drones, shut down the 2018 Olympic website, and prevented spectators from printing out reservations and attending the ceremony.
NBC's having a rough go because they also had, it wasn't a cyber attack, but they had a full like 15 seconds of dead air during the Super Bowl.
Really?
Which is, you know, like $2.5 million, I guess, of lost revenue just because of sort of an issue with that. Are cyber attacks at live events going to be a thing that becomes true as we're more dependent on, you know, web infrastructure to deliver the content to more and more people?
Probably.
They looked at the payload that they found the code that was causing this. And apparently all signs point to a Russian hacking group with ties to the Russian intelligence services by the name of Fancy Bear.
Oh, how fancy.
Fancy Bear. Now, I don't want any part of Fancy Bear's ire, but that's an interesting name for a hacking group.
All right. I want to clarify the drone thing. So there are 1,200 drones in that performance. It was recorded in December for the Guinness Book of World Records. What they had intended to do was they never intended to have those 1,200 fly during the opening ceremony. They intended to have 300 of them fly, and that, too, was scrapped. So no live drones at all. Sorry, Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, to have it recorded in December is what's sort of crazy to me.
Yeah.
Because it is February, right?
It is February. It is February. But it's a long time to get these planned. Now, you could also be watching it on like a streaming service like YouTube TV, I know. We're giving an update.
Oh, sure. I was going to do this later, but I woke up this morning. I turned on YouTube TV to watch my men's U.S. hockey, mm-hmm. and it popped up and said, thanks for being a subscriber. Here are all the Turner channel.
You got new channels.
I got CNN, I got TNT, AMC, and a couple, I think, Cartoon Network.
TBS,
yes.
Yeah, that's Turner Movie Classic, Turner Classic Movies. So does that make your YouTube TV experience? And now it's on Apple TV now?
So I think two things. One, because I've been an existing subscriber, they didn't raise the price. But if you're a new subscriber, they raise the price $5. So it's $40.
Ooh, always good in to lock in. And the prices go up March 13th.
I still can't fully recommend it. It's like, it's almost good.
So that's, I mean, if it was $35, and I think it was even lower ahead of that, right? That's a pretty good price for cord cutting.
No.
Those channels.
It's a wonderful price. It's just their interfaces aren't where they need to be. Like the third-party app for Apple TV and Roku is okay. It's still like buggy. And it has like quirks to it, and like the interface there to sort of get it, the shows that you want, you still can't control it. So when you hit a show to record, it records everything from that show, including the syndicated content.
Yeah, and I have noticed some inconsistencies, like if I'm recording a sports game and one channel has it, but another channel has it for a special weekend, they won't record that game.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so there's like little things they have to fix. These are all very fixable things, but before you give it a really high recommendation, they got
to
fix it.
Do you need to have Hulu in addition? I mean, to really get all the TV that you need?
Well, it depends on what you want. So now YouTube TV is really missing in terms of just the cable TV that's most watched is like the Food Network, a few of those type of Comedy Central.
Okay.
So some of the Viacom properties. But outside of that, for me, I got it because ESPN, I wanted live sports. And I wanted, you know, basic network channels and a few other bells and whistles.
It is interesting how DVR works for this, and I'm not sure if this is because of a licensing thing. You have to manually set the digital the DVR, the cloud-based DVR, to say record this channel, this time, this program,
that
and
must
then you're
be.
Accessing it. But are you actually pulling into, like let's say, YouTube servers tied to your account that recorded segment? It's not. It's like they just have everything stored and timestamped.
Sort of. So like from your locals, it seems to be pulling information recorded off that local channel.
And recorded for because you.
Yes. Hmm. Well, I mean, maybe it's not for me. Maybe it's for this whole region.
And there's pulling time. That's yeah. So I assume it's timestamped. So why isn't it possible for you to not have clicked record if you missed it, you know?
It's got to be contractual.
So it's contractual. It's licensing. It yeah. must be a licensing
so
issue.
So the thing is, what I found is there's shows that I've watched that I haven't hit record for. And if I'm doing that, it's pulling from essentially their online repository. So now I get ads that play kind of like YouTube plays them, mm-hmm. like interstitially throughout the show.
And I don't mind the, you know, ads that get but programmatically put in. Like, we want the future where the archive of broadcast can be, because that's a linear thing. We know exactly what was playing on terrestrial television at this time. We want to be able to pull and say, tell me what was on this channel at this time and that day, and watch the commercials and watch TV and have that archive.
Yeah.
And the data is being stored. It's just that it's not accessible.
We'll get there.
I think the contracts for this must be real gnarly, because each like group that they're working with, each sort of television group probably has different contractual agreements with YouTube, and managing all of that.
Imagine that the time machine, the Wayback Machine for yeah. TV. That would be so cool.
Well, I mean, music's gotten there already. Music got there years ago. Where you get anything you want, anytime.
Right,
any new
but
release.
Music, unless you're talking about radio and broadcast radio, does not have that indexing with time.
Yeah.
Right, TV, and yeah, there are reruns. So you're going to get, you know, so much of the same content over. But even the same content is different because of the commercials. And, you know, if I was able to have a service, and maybe it's not possible, but I believe technologically it could be, where I could say, take me back to 1995 and give me the channels I had on my TV on 1995 and let me flip through them and relive what Saturday morning was like back then. That would be super cool.
For about 30 minutes.
That's all you need.
Okay.
And I'd be flipping through like the four channels I had for 30 minutes back in 95. And yeah, give me a YouTube pre-roll. Give me some modern Tide ads, you know, before I jump into that session. But let me also see the ads from back then, too.
So are the ads that you see just indiscriminately inserted, like with a fade to black in the middle of a paragraph of dialogue?
No. They're at the proper moments.
They are.
If you're pulling the non-recorded content.
Okay.
It's where the commercial breaks are. Except
okay.
You're seeing them like you see the YouTube ads.
All right, cool.
They're more like they have a different sort of tone and flavor because they're internet ads.
I wonder how they to do that, if that is a manual process for finding those ad points or if they figure that out.
I mean, it happens for national broadcasts all the time. Yeah. You get regional ads
yeah.
and you know, regional buys and programmatic things and yeah. Anyway, it's a business model that seems to be working for YouTube. So speaking of business models, I do want to talk about MoviePass. We have an update on...
Either of you have MoviePass?
Still not yet. My brother has it, but I haven't taken advantage.
So what was interesting is the founder of MoviePass, I'm forgetting his name, was at the Recode conference this week and was talking about the behavior because the whole idea of MoviePass is you pay $10. And when you buy a ticket at a theater, they pay the theater the full price for that ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea being is, well, people on average go to 5 or 6 movies a year in the theater. And they're banking that with their subscription, they'll go to 10. So they'll make up some money on each one, but not much, like 20, 30 bucks. And what they've seen is that people are going, when they first subscribe, going to 2 or 3 movies a month. And so they're bleeding cash like you wouldn't believe, but they are also driving a ton of revenue. So what was interesting is he told a story about how AMC kind of has given them a cold shoulder about MoviePass.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I mean, people are still coming to your theater. You're still making the same amount of money
yeah.
off of them. And they removed the five most trafficked AMC theaters where the most movie pass subscribers were for a week.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, that is deep cut on them. And it apparently his subscribers, because he has all this data, are spending 1.5 times as much at concessions than a normal
How does he know that?
Goer. I don't know exactly how he knows that, because there has to be some sort of data passed back.
Yeah.
But that's the data he presented at the code
conference.
Certainly,
if they're going to three movies a month.
Oh, yeah.
They're buying
more. You're just
more
doing the multiple.
At concessions. And AMC seems to be shooting themselves in the foot by shutting down the service at their most popular
theaters.
There's
been a bunch of theaters that have come out and said they don't accept MoviePass now, and I kind of don't get it.
Yeah, I'd love to know. There must be a reasoning. I'd love to understand it.
But I don't get how this business model is going to be successful. Like, I know it's all about customer acquisition and people just regressing to the point where they forget that they have this subscription.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you go to 10 movies a year and you're paying for 12, is that enough money for the MoviePass to actually have function as a business?
The data.
I guess selling the data.
It's selling the data and billing that data.
I thought it was interesting. It made me slightly more convinced to try MoviePass, but I think I would be in that category of people that would blitz it in the first couple months and never use it.
And then never use it again. Well, it depends on what's in theaters, right? And depends on the season. It could be seasonal, like some right now with award season and the Oscars coming up. It's a great time to go back to theater, especially for second run movies where MoviePass is perfect for. If you missed seeing Get Out, you missed seeing Dunkirk last year, these things may be back in theaters.
If people are listening to this, AMC is playing Get Out for free this weekend on its first anniversary.
Well, that's pretty cool.
In select theaters, yeah.
That's really neat.
Does your brother like MoviePass?
I don't know if he uses it.
Okay.
He has it. It's one of those things that like, felt too good of a deal not to jump on board.
Somebody last month used MoviePass to get into Science versus Cinema.
Oh.
To watch Galaxy Quest. I was like,
wow.
Hey.
Yeah, nice.
All right.
You got more than you paid for with that one. Well, speaking of what's going to be in theaters this weekend, who here is hyped for Black Panther?
Me.
Yes. I am hype.
Yes. Yes. Black Panther now Rotten Tomatoes score of, I believe, 98% still.
Did you see the first bad review that came in? That critic got just savaged on Twitter.
Because his criticism was not enough action. Not enough punching dudes.
Yeah, which is pretty lame.
Yeah.
But what are you excited about for this movie? Like, why are you hyped?
I think we talked about it last week. I'm excited for a mainstream audience to be aware of the mythology that Marvel has built more recently than it hasn't been throughout the history of Marvel, but of Wakanda and the Black Panther character and what T'Challa means for the Marvel universe and the stature that character brings.
That's not why I'm interested.
Yeah. Lay it on me.
I the trailers look good and I liked him in the last movie he was in. Mm-hmm. What was that? Civil War.
Yeah. Stole the show in Civil War. So
it's good stuff.
And, it's going to be, a direct continuation.
Did you see this? The videos that were posted on Twitter? There have been several schools that have done this, but they're taking the students to go see it. There's a school called the Ron Clark Academy posted a video of the entire student body discovering that they were going to go see the film together, and there's a freaking party. I mean, they're dancing on the tables.
Representation matters. Good stories matter. Like, yeah. I think I'm excited for three reasons. One is exactly what Norm said. Black Panther has a lot of interesting story, and to see that fully realized on screen. Two, Infinity Stone. I got to be me. I got to find that last Infinity Stone. And then three, I think we can agree that women have gotten short shrift in Marvel movies in terms of action and characters. And from everything I've heard, there is this badass female army that's going to show up in this movie and defend Wakanda. I don't know, take part in Wakanda. They're like the CIA, I guess. And I'm really excited to see what those action scenes look like, because from what we saw in the trailer, just look amazing.
Are there any of the other Avengers in this film?
Don't know. I don't know.
Because there's nobody in the trailers, right? I mean, nobody I can see.
No, I expect at least one to show up.
Okay.
You think it needed that crutch?
I don't think it needed that crutch. I think it's going to be in one of the stingers.
Mm. I mean, would you say that the Captain America films needed a crutch? Because they got the most of them.
No, but the Captain America films, but the Thor films, I think, I felt like. Mm. Like, Thor 2 had the Steve Rogers cameo, and I thought that was probably unnecessary.
I haven't seen it, because you keep telling me I don't need to see it.
You don't need to see it. As long as you've seen Thor 3, you're all good. That's a good movie to put on the background. You may also watch, if you go to watch Black Panther this weekend, a trailer for another comic book movie. This one is Marvel Studios, but it's part of the Marvel Studios Sony deal, and it's a new trailer for Venom.
Did you watch it?
I did. Trailer? Missing one important thing.
Venom?
Venom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Set in San Francisco. So you got, like, Venom in, I guess, the shared universe now as Ant-Man, because that's all two of these coming out. Also San Francisco. Venom starring Tom Hardy. How can he be Venom and Bane at the same time?
Oh, same guy?
Same guy. Wow. Tom Hardy.
Well, I thought Venom was like a Spider-Man.
He's a Spider-Man villain.
Huh.
Just really quickly, there's a alien symbiote that comes and turns a rival to Peter Parker into a hideous Spider-Man villain that has Spider-Man's powers, essentially, but more amplified. And yes. He sort of runs on rage.
And the reason he has Spider-Man's powers is because the alien symbiote originally attached itself to Spider-Man, to Peter Parker, and gave Spider-Man the famous black suit, which was a storyline in the Sam Raimi Spider-Man 3, and I also had Venom with Topher Grace, but Sam Raimi was famously not interested in telling that story, and so it was really short-shrifted.
And, you know, Topher Grace is not putting the fear of God in anyone.
Well, also...
Tom Hardy can scare you a little bit.
The approach, though, with the Topher Grace was he was supposed to be a Black Mirror version of Spider-Man, competing photographers, but Eddie Brock, the character, has had various incarnations in the Marvel's universe, in the comic books, and so Tom Hardy does fit more of the Eddie Brock character, I think, that's in the comic books today. It's a tormented soul with a symbiote, and he's a monster anti-hero, we don't know. But the trailer clearly doesn't show much, which I guess...
Are we going to get Spider-Man in this movie?
I don't think so. I don't... See, that's a good question. Do you want this to be Spider-Man free or not? I think the movie can be sustained being Spider-Man free, but do you want to see a Spider-Man
cameo? Why would
they
do that? The last Spider-Man movie was a big hit for them, right?
Well, this is a different story.
I don't think it needs Spider-Man, but it needs something for Venom to rail against. It needs something, some hero,
Carnage.
Something. No, that would be awful. It would be awful.
You hate the Carnage? No maximum Carnage?
No, too early.
Oh, wow.
They need to develop out the character.
I guess they do need to explain the power of Venom and why Venom has Spider-Man's powers, but also amplified. The coolest thing about the suit, the black suit for Spider-Man, is that the webs came out the top as opposed to underneath the wrist. It was on top of the hand.
How about that?
Yeah. And Venom has his own webs.
That's probably enough Marvel navel gazing.
When the Spider-Man came out, there was a Spider-Man pinball machine, and it was amazing.
You talking about the Sam Raimi Spider-Mans?
Yeah. And then they made the special edition was the black Spider-Man.
It must have been for Spider-Man 3.
It was the same game, just reskinned.
All three. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's what I know.
Is that a collector's one?
It was. Yeah, I guess it is. Mm. They actually reskinned it, and they re-released the whole Spider-Man game as a comic book reskin. So now you get the comics as the art all over the game.
Oh, that's cool.
Redid all the voices.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I like that more than the photos of
me too.
The actors. Pay some artists to do some pinball art. Either of you caught up with Star Trek Discovery?
Yeah, I finally did. It's peak TV update over here.
Now, I saw something on Twitter. It was like Star Trek Discovery finale, season finale on Netflix. Do you guys know anything about
that? So I believe that happened because Star Trek Discovery outside the U.S. Mm-hmm. is a Netflix exclusive.
Oh.
So people in Canada, overseas.
Gotcha.
And they wrote the show to have commercial breaks, so it can be syndicated at some point beyond CBS All Access. And the first episode had commercial breaks because it was presented on CBS. But the finale was this past weekend.
Are we going spoiler free?
I don't think we... I'm going to let Jeremy decide because he's the one who hasn't seen it.
Tell me everything.
Wow.
Give it to me.
Wow. Hold on.
Light.
Whoa, the red light. We can do this now.
We do this?
We can do this.
Is this a thing?
We can do this. If you're watching the video.
That's a great idea.
Isn't it?
Whose idea was this?
It was a tested listener's idea.
Wait, I'm hitting the button and nothing's happening.
Hold on. Let's change. Code red. Code black.
What button do I hit?
Well,
black alert.
You got to find the receiver. Plus, there's like four transmitters over there. You got to find where. You got to point. Just keep clicking. Point
keep
different
clicking,
directions.
Keep clicking.
I'll give you this one.
Okay. Oh, no. All right. I will go spoiler free to keep the conversation going they figure it out.
I got one red.
I thought it was disappointing. I thought it ended with it was anticlimactic, the finale. I thought it was there were some great twists and turns that got us there, but the what they had built up to with the penultimate episode for the season had a great cliffhanger, and I don't think they delivered. And I think it all resolved too quickly, even though they've already booked it for a second season. And there was a cliffhanger. No. Let's go full code red. I don't want this blinking stuff.
We don't know how.
Oh, come on, guys. You just got to point in the right direction.
No. It's
like, press all the buttons to change the lights.
Oh, this is horrible.
Oh no, you've changed the other one. Now we're code green.
This is horrible.
Code green.
We're going to go code green. Behind Kishore, the light is green. Green for spoilers, I guess. We're going to figure this out.
We'll figure this out next week.
Yeah. Let's go full spoilers for now.
Well, I think we should back up and say, like, they've been in the Mirror Universe.
Yeah.
Okay, what's that?
The Mirror Universe is a famous Star Trek trope. Almost every series has gone into the Mirror Universe.
TNG did not.
I forgot about that.
Original series, Bearded Spock.
Yeah.
Classic Bearded Spock.
Okay.
It's basically all the same characters, but they have, like, kind of an evil tilt to them for some reason. And
for some reason,
yeah, it's the Mirror Universe, so they're somehow like evil, and they go there, and some characters that have died in our current iteration are alive.
Oh wow!
So there was a lot of theorizing in the Star Trek and Star Trek Discover community of like, how are they going to retcon the past to allow for the ship to be introduced in canon? Spock's, you know, adoptive sister, also the spore drive technology. Like, and, you know, I'm not even talking about the look of the ship because I don't care about how the continuity for looks. Like, modern day technology, we get better graphics, better makeup effects. That's just how production works. But the story, right? So a lot of people were theorizing that maybe they were in the Mirror Universe the whole time, that Discovery did not exist in the canonical, the original series universe. But turns out, nope, it is canonical, but several episodes of this series of Discovery then had the ship transported to the Mirror Universe, where the Terran Empire rules instead of the Federation.
Wow.
And it was also in Star Trek Enterprise, so we got a little bit of the references to the Enterprise show and Captain Archer and NX-01. And do we want to reveal the big character twist?
Yeah, dude, we got the green light.
All right. Jason Isaacs, the captain of Discovery.
Oh, this is the big character twist?
Of course.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about Tyler.
That's the second there. Okay.
As I recall, kind of a military figure.
Yes, right. Military figure, yeah. Kind of a hard ass.
Yeah.
The one who recruited, what's her name, Michael Burnham, mm-hmm. from being court-martialed to be on the Discovery. Like, it was a different take on a Star Trek captain. It turned out he was from the Mirror Universe all along.
Like a plant?
He came accidentally over to our universe and swapped places with the Lorca, and then has been trying to get back to his universe to start a revolution the whole time.
That's why he was edgier, but
he's not good.
Good-ish.
He's still bad, and that was my problem with the show. Whereas in the Mirror Universe, if black is white and up is down,
yeah.
You would think that the people you thought were good were bad, and maybe it's mirrored where the people who are evil are good.
Yeah.
And so
perspective.
What does it mean to have to be a freedom fighter in a universe where everyone is evil, right? And I thought it would be cool for Lorca, because there's actually a classic Justice League storyline where from Earth 2, where Luthor is a hero in Earth 2 in the Mirror Universe, Lex Luthor, and he is fighting the fight that he can never win, which is trying to bring good in a universe where bad rules supreme. And I love the tragedy of that. But you just had an asshole wanting to take over and be the ruler of the evil universe.
I would say the storyline let me down there.
The conceit was great.
The other thing is that Tyler, do you know Tyler?
No.
They introduced a character mid-season that gets rescued from the Klingon Federation War, and he becomes the new security officer on the Star Trek Discovery.
A Klingon.
He's a human.
Oh.
With a whole full backstory, and it turns out the big character twist for him was he was a plant, and he was actually a Klingon.
He's one of those Klingon from the early scenes.
From the first episode.
Yeah.
The albino Klingon got then transformed into a human somehow. Through body mutilation and a memory transplant.
Yeah, it's weird.
And so this character, Tyler, is, even though looks human and has human memories, is half Klingon.
Yep.
It didn't make a lot of sense. It was a pretty bad twist.
But it's really just plastic surgery?
Yeah.
It's not like, you know how in Next Generation, and you've been rich watching, whenever they go to a planet and they go, we got to get facial reconstructive surgery to look like the locals.
Right.
Like Beverly Crusher, they go to, you know, they go to sick bay and Dr. Crusher does some magic wand scan and now they have ridges on their noses to look like the locals when it's just special effects. This is like that on a full body scale.
Wow. All right.
It gets worse.
Bones cracking and everything.
Then they like somehow wrap up the entire war.
Yep.
In like 10 minutes.
Yep.
The war. Finale.
The whole Klingon human war.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing ends with a distress call to Discovery from the Enterprise.
It ends on the cliffhanger. So you remember how 3 weeks ago on the podcast, I showed you that GIF, that short Vimeo video of what the Enterprise, original Enterprise would look like if it was in Star Trek Discovery?
The original Enterprise. You mean the TOS? Kirk,
TOS Enterprise. Yeah. Remember I showed you that short, like, 5-second clip? Yeah. That looks pretty cool.
Yep.
They basically had that as the cliffhanger. I don't know if it was that exact clip leaked, but it looked very much like it.
Wait, when you say the Enterprise, which Enterprise got sent the distress call?
The Enterprise.
Kirk's?
No A, no B, no C, no D.
All right. All right, Scotty.
1701, wow. Captain Pike.
No way.
Okay. Yeah, Captain Pike pre the cage.
Wow.
If this sounded messy, that's how it occurred when you were watching.
But that's exciting. That's exciting.
No. There's parts of this that you were like, oh, this is going somewhere interesting. This is going somewhere interesting. And then it takes like this left turn. Like, I think the most generous thing you can say is this second half of the season was just uneven. Yeah. It had great ideas, terrible execution.
But I don't. How did they resolve this Klingon war? Because that doesn't get resolved until Next Gen, right?
Poorly.
Yeah.
Poorly. Yeah. Very poorly.
Huh. Weird. Messing with the time again.
Yeah. All right, let's turn off our spoiler alert.
That was good, man. That was much better than watching it.
Come on. Get it back to that. Oh, no.
Oh, I found red. Oh. I found red.
Get it back to blue.
There we go.
While you guys fix that, it's not that color blue. It's one more tinted blue. We also talked on Still Untitled about The Good Place. This will be sufficient. Kishore,
amazing.
You have watched it?
So, yeah, I've been a weekly watcher of the show. And we should highlight it. This is a show run by Mike Schur. He crafted the whole idea of this. He worked on The Office previously.
Parks and Rec.
And it just has this amazing conceit and then wonderful acting and just jaw-dropping twists and turns.
Really? I totally slept on this. So I got to watch this because we've been looking for something to watch with the whole family.
This is a perfect show for the whole family to watch.
And is it on Hulu?
It is.
All right. It is.
Sweet.
It's on Netflix. Also, for whole first season
is
on
it?
Netflix.
Yeah.
And the whole second season is on the NBC app or Hulu.
And so you watch the first season. It's sort of like a half season. It's only 13 episodes. And when you reach the end of the first season, you're like, how do they top that?
Yeah.
And they didn't, but second season is definitely worthy follow-up.
Yeah. Wonderful writing, wonderful acting, and the characters, you fall in love with them.
It's not the same documentary style as The Office.
No. Totally different model, but the acting is really wonderful, and the characters, you just fall in love with them, especially Janet. What I think is also funny is they have guest stars show up. You're like, oh, something's about to happen. Like Maya Rudolph shows up and you're like, huh, wonder what this is about.
Does anybody play themselves? You know, like people who have died?
No.
Okay. No.
Right.
That would be funny, though.
Yeah.
That's probably coming.
Yeah. Moving on. We know we got one more Star Wars left in this trilogy. Episode 9. Right, in the new trilogy, and J.J. Abrams is writing it right now, I assume, in pre-production. But they have hired an art director for Episode 9, and it's Paul Inglis, who is most recently the art director for Blade Runner 2049.
Sign me up.
Anyone who bought the Making of Blade Runner book may be very happy about this. And maybe they'll even go with some of the miniatures. Go with miniature building like they did for 2049. That'd be really awesome.
Did they not do miniatures for the last couple? I felt like there were a lot of practical effects.
They had maquettes that they built for references, but they also didn't have cityscapes.
But 2049 was like heavy on that.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think they're going to let him go as far as he wants to go? Because usually Star Wars isn't this like oversaturated, high contrast world. are we going to see that a little bit more? Because that's what Blade Runner feels like. These like vibrant colors, this incredibly rich contrast landscape.
I mean, he can definitely build a world that looks like it's been lived in, for sure.
Oh, for sure.
Right? And I don't think Lucasfilm is going to be afraid to dive into uncharted territories in terms of visual design. They did Canto Blight in episode 8, and that was something we hadn't really seen before. And episode 7 had Maz's temple, and that was a little different, you know, a variant on the cantina, but a lot of interesting characters and location pieces. So people want to see something old mixed with something new.
Lucas used to talk about how the original trilogy each had a palette. You know, how like the Jedi was green for the moon of Endor.
Yeah.
And then you had, you know, Hoth and the white and everything else.
For people who are fans of Firefly,
it's back. It's back. Kind we of. Finally got this.
Don't tease me.
Kind of.
Stop it.
Tell us how it's back.
They're releasing a series of books. I think it's Titan Books is the publisher of it.
Okay.
And they're continuing stories. And Joss Whedon is actually a consultant on these books. So he's going to play a role in this. I believe, they didn't actually say, I believe these stories will take place in between the series and the movie, if that means anything to people. I'm excited for any continuation of that universe because I don't think the TV show is coming back by any stretch. I mean, I've heard Nathan Fillion for years basically say like, yeah, I would do it if all these people paid money and got us all out of our contracts for existing TV shows we're on.
Well, and they're all so much more expensive now.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm excited for this universe to continue in any way, shape, or form because the only way it has is either been a comic book or a board game. So to see actual books with depth of story again, with Joss involved sounds great to me.
What was the character's name, the African-American bishop or priest? Book.
Book,
yeah. Right?
Yeah.
They won't bring him back, I imagine.
Well, he died in the movie.
Yeah.
So if this takes place between the show and the movie.
Oh.
That, which is my guess.
Great, because I like the
Shepherd Book, yeah. And I think Wash will be back, and that's what I'm hoping.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that would have to also be the case. Interesting. And then one last bit of pop culture news. If you've been interested in, if you watched the movie Coco, and if you haven't, go watch it. But if you are interested in a replica from the film, they've been making guitars from the film, and they have just ramped up production of it, so doubled its production, made in Mexico. So I think it's a really nice artifact, a real world artifact from an animated film.
I don't think, is that what the story says? I thought the story was just that guitar sales have doubled. Like
really?
In general, like interest in the Coco has, you know, spurred guitar sales, like an interest in playing music. Yeah, the city of Paracho in Mexico. Yeah, well known for elaborate guitar designs.
Oh, all right. Well then.
Huge boom in guitar sales.
You can also buy one of those guitars.
Yeah.
Directly influenced the movie Coco.
Yeah. Is that it?
I think that's it. Any last bits of tech or pop culture news?
No, let's do some tech.
Let's talk about tech.
So I got this notification this morning at 7 a.m. about this tested video that...
7 a.m.? You were up. Yeah, that's right.
I'm on notification squad about this autonomous drone. And I saw this little thumbnail of Norm running around in a forest.
Yeah. Well, that wasn't me, actually. It was the CEO of the company. But I did run through the forest in the video.
I'm so hype about Skydio. And you guys have been on Skydio for a long time.
No, we actually just found about it recently.
Oh, I thought you guys had heard about them years ago.
I had
ago.
Read up on them before, but no one had seen the quadcopter. So there is a video on the site right now. Hopefully you guys have watched it. If not, you can listen to the podcast and go watch it. But they just announced and revealed their first product called the R1. And we were, I think, rightfully skeptical of autonomous drone startups. I think people out there have been burned by them, products that either never shipped or ones that even did ship but never fulfilled their promises.
DJI is like the big quadcopter manufacturer.
The biggest.
They make the Phantom and the Mavic and all these, the Inspire. And some of these drones that they've released have started to have these kind of features, like SDKs, and they've allowed other people to develop them. Then we've seen these attempts at being able to track people, and they're limited.
And I think the approach that a company like DJI has on these quadcopters is moves from – they're still primarily transmitter-based. Some of them are controlled by an app or controlled by a handheld transmitter that you pair with an app. But like the Phantom 4 has some obstacle avoidance for safety, but you're going to be flying it with two sticks and on a transmitter, manual control as to pilot the quad. And the ones that are more like gesture controlled or the ones that have subject tracking, they're not made to run the whole time with subject tracking. Like the Mavic, those mm-hmm. are still, you still are going to then switch to manual control to take off and land and to get the shot you want. And but that's because subject tracking is not easy.
That's the bigger problem is that even when it's in subject tracking mode, what we've seen has, it's been very limited results. Like you need a wide open space. You can't have too many obstacles. Mm-hmm. It can lose tracking if it gets too much distance between you and the camera.
It's both a hardware and a software problem. On the hardware side, to get good subject tracking, you actually need sensors that can have you track around the quadcopter, you know? And it's not about having a LiDAR sensor, but you need cameras. And most of these on the DJI side or something like the Hover, you have one camera.
And to be honest, I don't mean to say it's disappointing because it's like it's amazing that these things do what they do at all with mm-hmm. the tiny processors that they have.
That's right. But the Skydio went with a full approach where they went full autonomous from the start. This was not designed to be something you are going to be controlling with the two-stick transmitter. While you can use a virtual transmitter on your phone, one of the modes, this is made to just fly on its own. And so the promise is already way up there. And I would say it's up there with what like the Lily drone promised. You know, we saw those Facebook videos and those YouTube videos of what Lily drone, and that famously burned.
Was that the rock climber who released a drone to take a picture?
Yeah, and the water, going down the water, like the rapids, white water rafting, and over bridges and stuff, and that was vaporware. And they got sued by their backers. And I think that Skydio took a lot of lessons and saw what those companies, how they approached their launch. And that's why they got investment and didn't announce a product until this week.
Until they're shipping.
Until they're shipping 2 weeks from now.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think they're manufacturing.
They also have a lot of bona fides on this project. Like the guys that founded it worked on, what was the name of the Google?
Google Wing.
On the Wing.
Yeah.
And then before that at Media Lab, did you see some of their projects at Media Lab where they flew like an autonomous plane in a parking garage?
Yep.
Oh, you showed footage of that in your video.
Yeah, some of the early projects. That was using LiDAR, I believe. But mm-hmm. they put a huge bet on computer vision and on neural networks to improve their computer vision systems and the processing to get light and cheap and power efficient enough that they can put it all in a drone on a product coming out in 2018.
They made this bet years ago before the technology was even capable of it.
Right. And all I can say is that in the two-hour demo that we got, it works. Like, they took it out of a backpack, and the profile of this drone is very flat, so in many ways it does look a lot like a larger version of the Hover mini drone that I tested. It doesn't fold up, though, but it's flat so it could fit in a backpack. They held it out, launched the app, connects it via Wi-Fi to the drone, and on the app, it'll say it's ready to launch when the 13 cameras surrounding the quadcopter, all around it, in stereo pairs, it's 12 plus the main camera, the video camera, when that detected that there were no obstacles in behind it. So it's ready to launch, the motor's revved up, props revved up, they let it go, it flew up away from you, and then turned around to look at you and kind of hovered in that spot. From there, you can enable one of 8 different flight modes. And we just did the follow to start. And the follow mode does exactly as you expect. You can set like a distance and a relative angle to you, tilting the camera. And it will stay between 3 meters and 10 meters away from you. So 10 feet to 30 feet, which is a good distance. And we just ran through a forest. We ran around trees. In the video, you can see me like trying to dodge and do hide and seek. And I was doing that because this drone felt visceral and alive. Like, I wasn't thinking of this drone, this machine, as if it was like a handheld quad where I was worried about it going to crash into a tree. I was actively trying to get it to confuse it, and it would not lose tracking of me. It was hunting me.
It looked to me like you were playing it too easy. Like, you're understanding and experience with these drones mm-hmm. led you to think, well, if I run around this tree, it's probably going to lose me.
Yeah.
And it didn't.
It didn't.
It just looked like, give me a challenge.
Yeah.
I mean, it looked like you could have tried even harder to outrun it, run around more trees, and
well,
it would have had
no problem. We did figure eights. We would, you know, ran down these paths and came back. And I'd say it wasn't 100% perfect. There were scenarios where we got too close to it and it lost tracking. Or there's one shot, actually, it's really interesting. The founder, Adam Bree, was running, and the drone was following it. And in the field of view of the camera, he runs in front of his other co-founder, Matt, who's wearing the same T-shirt. Mm. And the moment he runs in, like, past Matt and does, like, a hard right turn, the drone tracks on the Matt because they're wearing the exact same color T-shirt and T-shirt.
Founders of startups all look the same.
That's right, yeah. And so, you know, it still can be improved, yep. but the obstacle avoidance. So there are two things we're talking about. One is subject tracking, and one is obstacle avoidance. The obstacle yeah. avoidance system, it's mapping understanding of that area around it and its predictive capabilities of where it's flying and where the obstacles in front of it will be so it can avoid it.
And where its target will go.
And where its target will go. It's managing all those things and juggling them at many times a second. That seemed to work.
It. Do you think it'll get better as it does more runs? Because as it learns an area, does it keep that information somewhere?
They don't store like a global map. I think there is GPS built into this drone, but it's not like as, you know,
it's not a Roomba that's like mapping an area and storing that information.
Yeah, I think it's doing more mapping in real time. It's not building a giant database of the world map. Or maybe it is. I'm not actually sure. But in terms of how well it will track people and other objects, that is something that they say will 100% get better over time because their data sets will just improve and those run it through their neural networks again.
Do you have to train it to follow you every time? Like, do you have to go through some sort of calibration?
No calibration necessary.
How do you choose who to follow?
So on the app, you have the view from the main camera, which is the only, you know, the 4K color camera, and it will identify. For us, we had four people out in the open, and all four of us had little boxes on the app targeted. And we just hit the plus on the box, and then it'll lock onto that person. And then it'll have like an animated icon saying that that person is targeted.
You know, everyone this week is going overboard about the Boston Dynamics robot opening the door. This, by far, is way more impressive to me.
Yeah, totally.
And not to diminish what Boston Dynamics did, but this is this has so many different applications and utilities, and also crosses an uncanny valley, too.
It 100% crosses the uncanny valley, and it said to me that if this is a first-gen product, then the drone future where we see in movies and video games where the drones are perfectly navigating around city streets and other obstacles and not worried, I mean, unless you're like shooting at it or throwing tennis balls at it, they're not going to crash.
Yep. Dude, you could totally imagine this vision being put to use to avoid those kind of things just as well. Mm-hmm. You know, if you could see somebody aiming a gun, you could imagine military interest in this kind of drone autonomy.
Yeah.
Where it would maybe take evasive action.
Yes. It is taking evasive action, right? It's taking evasive action when it's flying, but there's no reason why if it was standing still, it couldn't dodge. All they have to do is improve the frame rate and maybe the quality of the camera sensor.
The camera is easily fixed, right? That's just we're in a first-generation product because those exist out on the market. I'm wondering, with that much processing power, are they ever going to catch up on the flight time? Because this is a shorter flight time than
16 minutes.
16 versus 20, and that's like a big hurdle for most people.
I think the 16 minutes is... So the thing we always say about drones is that there is a time dilation effect when you're flying a quadcopter and when you're on any type of like motorized thing. Like 5 minutes feels like 10 minutes. Even when you're in VR, 5 minutes feels like 10 minutes. 60 minutes is a lot. It doesn't hit that like magic 30-minute mark where you're never, ever thinking about battery, right? If you have two batteries in 30 minutes, that's most of what you need. 16 minutes isn't going to be good enough for a production environment where you're going to need to go on multiple flights over and over to get that perfect shot. But for the type of activities I think you'll be doing with a drone like this, if you're just like a small sporting event, running a racetrack, biking down a hill or something, skiing down, right, snowboarding down, you're going to get at least one run.
Yeah, it's good for a run.
Mm-hmm. Good for a run, but is it good for a day? And probably not good for a day unless you have multiple batteries.
Yeah. But man, I mean, you were imagining the security potential of this kind of thing. Like, if you could train it to automatically charge itself.
So that was, we had a conversation about this yesterday, and it's not even something I brought up in the interview. But if it can track people through deep learning, like, the easy thing for it to do would be track fiducial markers, like fixed markers. And there's no reason why, if they, it's actually a simpler task, but no reason why they couldn't program it in and build a system where you could have the drone look for certain fiducial markers that could be its charging spots. And it's flying around the world, sees the landing pad with the marker, and then if they had some type of wireless, you know, inductive charging, land on the marker perfectly aligned, charge up, and then fly off again, you wouldn't need human control at all.
I mean, that for surveying, for security, there's going to be, you know, big tech companies that have drone security squads now.
Right. Let's get a fleet of them, having on rotation, charging, and having one up in the air at all times. That will be a new normal. And the fear of, you know, power lines gets completely bypassed because this can work around those things. And, you know, and it can, you know, it can in the future probably will track cars and dogs and recognize all sorts of things and be a data gathering tool.
Now, when I first heard about this, because I don't first saw it in your video, but when I first heard about it, I was thinking, I'm not as interested because I like flying drones. Mm-hmm. This is a completely different category.
Yeah.
This is like they've gone full in on autonomy.
Yeah.
In much the way, is it the Mavic, the original Mavic?
The Mavic Pro, the Mavic Air.
One of those is like it doesn't even have a controller.
Spark.
The Spark doesn't even have a controller. Yeah. It's just the app. Yeah. And I'm not as interested in that because I'm not a good pilot, but I enjoy it. And I want to be able to fly it. This is a completely different direction.
Yeah.
This is like, I'm not interested in flying drones. I just want the coverage. And what they've done is far beyond anything else has done in that category. But it also comes at a price.
It's $2,500. And I think that's expected because they're making these in the U.S. and they're machining. It's machined aluminum for the body parts and the carbon fiber for the frame. And the technology is new, right?
Yeah, Gen 1 product.
Gen 1 product.
Totally early adopter situation here.
My concern isn't about its flight capabilities or its cinematography. That's still, you know, to be tested. My concern is people who buy this want, it's going to be worth it if you can get usable video. If this is something you can use regularly and you are someone who goes snowboarding or you are someone who wants to film some type of sports activity or active in an interesting way, like, if you can get hours and hours of video, it's going to pay for itself. The quality of the video is something that I'm not sold on yet.
Okay.
It's 4K, 30 FPS. You can't do, I would love for it to be able to do 120 FPS at 1080, right? If it's flying at 25 miles per hour, show me that. Show me the action and show me your flight in 120 FPS. That's going to be gorgeous.
You can do 120 or 60 1080, right?
60, 1080,
yeah.
30, 4K. And 60, I think, will be okay. Exposure control, no color control. You know, the basics of things that you would expect to have on, like, a GoPro, lighting profiles, color profiles. I don't think you have that here. They say it's a good Sony image processor and they have a good imaging pipeline. But this is something we'll have to test when we get
it. It just feels like Gen 1.
There's also no yaw stabilization. It's only
the gimbal.
Two-axis
gimbal. Yeah, and I understand why they didn't do that. Yaw doesn't make sense if the gimbal is on the same plane as the props. You know, the three-axis gimbals usually hang underneath the quadcopter, and they think the yaw stabilization and control can happen with the tracking itself, with the turning of the actual quadcopter. So they just have the pitch and roll. Which are, I think, essential if you want stabilized video.
Yeah, I think they're essential, but I do like that yaw stabilization you get on the Phantom line.
Yeah. So it is. It's coming out in 2 weeks, and that's probably the other most shocking thing about it is that they can deliver something so quickly. So we'll see.
Oh, man. If I were making music videos, I would buy a fleet of these things.
Oh, that's okay. We didn't get access to this video, so you guys haven't seen it yet. But they shared with us one of their coworkers filmed a music video.
Did you see it?
I saw it.
Oh,
it was awesome and hilarious. He had it 2 meters above the ground, so the ground is treated like another obstacle, so it hovers above the ground, and it was in lead mode, which is the most difficult mode, I think, for these quadcopters to do, which is it's in front of you, it's trying to predict where you're walking and have you centered and go directly straight backward
and
not veer off axis. And so he was had this like pop song playing. He was dancing, and it was like there was a jib camera in front of him, and he was walking toward it and doing this choreographed dance to the music, to the drone, and singing while it was flying backwards.
Was he walking in a straight line?
In a straight, and he was walking. He was turning and walking in a straight line along this path.
Yeah,
and it was hilarious and awesome.
Wow.
And it totally looked like they had someone with, a jib, or walking backwards with a steady cam.
Yeah.
Or with a stabilized camera.
I mean, what if you're doing a stage performance, like Cirque du Soleil or anyone doing a dance performance would want one of these just to document their show. To put it in orbit mode and let it be up on stage during a rehearsal. Yeah. Be amazing.
Or sports. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Lots of potential. I mean, I don't think it's $2,500 is expensive, so I completely understand people out there who say that's not for me and that's a crazy high price point. But it's more about the promise and potential of this technology that I was completely wowed by. All right. Some other technologies. Right after we recorded last week, Tesla had its earnings call. And yes, they addressed the Falcon Heavy. It launches with that. But they also announced some Model 3 updated estimates.
Mm, funny. Coincidental, they waited till after our show.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. people who pre-ordered a Model 3 back in 2016 put their $1,000 down. They can go on the Tesla website and they can get a shipping estimate. And they did confirm that the first batch of Model 3s that will be available in large quantities to consumers will be the high-end premium model, the $49,000 model.
Not surprising.
It's a little worrisome because anyone who bought in with the promise of a $35,000 car plus tax breaks may not get the tax breaks depending on where you are in the queue. And someone like you, Jeremy, what's your estimate for the early?
For the standard battery?
No, the big the premium model.
Oh, it's the same as yours, whatever that was.
April to June.
Yeah.
Which is coming up soon, and that will be exciting for April, June. It's feeling real, and hopefully they can keep it, they can stick to that production pipeline. Mm-hmm. But the standard battery is like early 2019.
Yeah, mine is late this year, but
late 2018 probably. For you. So if I wanted to get a standard battery, $35,000 car, that'd be 2019, and that may be too late for the tax breaks.
I understand that hurts some people, but for thinking about this from Tesla's perspective, like one, this isn't the first time they've missed estimates on sort of delivery of product. But frankly, like scaling up production, and we think this is tied to production issues at the Gigafactory, scaling up production for a fleet of cars like this is so non-trivial.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially there's barely any other car manufacturer that's trying to do what they're trying to do at this scale. So I'm just not surprised at all by these delays. And even though you love your Bolt, there's nothing on the horizon in 2018 or even early 2019 that is going to rival the Model 3. So I don't think like they're missing a window with these delays.
Yeah. I think it's more about looking at how they explain the delays and whether they feel confident they can overcome some of the supply chain issues and manufacturing issues in terms of scaling. Not that they're a problem with the cars that we know of, but in terms of how they're building these cars in tandem and at large scale to get up to that several thousand cars per month.
There are other self-driving cars, like that's its big sexy thing. It's the supercharger network and the self-driving capability. And there's going to be more and more of those coming out as time goes by, you know, as car manufacturers start to include that feature this year and next. And so the longer it takes them to ship their cars, the more real competition there's going to be.
Is it the autonomous that really makes a difference? I think it's a sexy ass car.
Oh, no, no doubt. It's a beautiful car.
And I just think the range is the other thing that are the two big factors. I don't think anyone, I won't speak for other people. I'm not looking at this as like an autonomous play. I think that's like the bonus that's on top of it.
I also feel like this is, even though at $35,000 it feels like an accessible car, it still is an early adopter technology, these EVs. Not
1,000%.
Just the autonomous driving, but batteries. Technologies, because that could change. And we have stories out of Dyson now. Dyson, yes, the maker of vacuum cleaners and hand dryers and your air purifiers. I don't even know if they make air purifier. But they talked about they've invested $2 billion into making an EV that they say they will ship in 2020 and 2021 and with multiple models. And so they want to actually invest in battery technology, solid-state batteries as opposed to lithium-ion ones, that if they can...
What? What's a solid-state battery?
Don't ask me about the science behind it.
Okay.
But they think those will be more efficient and have longer life than the lithium-ion batteries. Now, Tesla has invested in this giant factory to make batteries already.
Yes.
And they must be looking at, you know, they have billions to invest in battery technologies.
They want to sell to Dyson, probably. I know that if they're not interested in those type of batteries, they won't. But
So the question is the car that you're going to buy, this EV, like the Bolt you've already bought or the Tesla that we may be buying this year, is that battery technology going to be outdated in 5 years? If it is, that's a little scary. Think about it. If it's 10, 15 years, that's okay because that's a car lifespan of a car.
Yeah. But, I mean, come on. I mean, if 5 years is pretty good, too, for the length of time that you might keep a car, it's going to have resale value. You know, I don't think that's so bad. The bigger concern is recycling and how will battery recycling improve by the time that you are done with the car? And that's like, just environmentally, that's kind of...
Well, at least with cars, there's infrastructure for that to happen because there's already oil recycling programs in place. So the idea of if you have to go get your battery replaced, at least the recycling rate should be high. By the way, solid-state battery, since we glossed over that, it's a way of packing higher energy density but like into the same sort of size, but at the same time not having the flammability risk that liquid does, because a lot of the liquid ion, like the lithium-ion batteries, when they're exposed to oxygen, they can catch on fire. The solid-state batteries have different material construction. Some of them are ceramic, some of them have like magnesium, some of them are different salts that, when they're exposed to oxygen, don't have that flammability risk. But by basically being able to have these two different solids play the electrode and anode, cathode and anode, you can still get that sort of transfer of electrons.
And the same of storage?
Better storage. You get better energy density because there's a couple ways to explain it, but like you just have more electrons in that small space.
Currently it's more expensive, I assume?
It's not even, like, expensive doesn't even begin to address it because it's just untested in a lot of factors at this scale.
God, you know stuff, man.
I want to jump over to some small bits. There is a new version of VLC 3.0 with support for 8K playback, HDR, and Chromecast.
Yeah, the Chromecast support. Are you excited about that?
I am excited about that.
Apparently, your Chromecast, like normally, it only supports X number of formats, and this will stream anything to it.
Exactly. I haven't tested it out to see how, like, if there's any jittering or delays or any sort of issues with any of the casting, but I'm thrilled about this. It essentially finally deals with, like, I've used Plex as an intermediary to handle some of that format conversion, and to have VLC as a more lightweight option available, I think it's wonderful.
A lot of cool updates to it. I had my fingers crossed for mediocre, bare, you know, just the barest amount of VR support, where you'd be able to get a black environment and stereoscopic video or something
like that.
But it's kind of like the whatever big screen started out as a prototype. Yeah. That'd be great to get in VLC. I'd like to be able to just boot up VLC and watch 3D videos in VR.
And be able to decode as many and high bit rate, different container file, different codec videos as possible. It will also now support HD DVD .evo files if you have those.
That's cute.
Yeah. You need a HD DVD player, much like the Xbox 360 accessory.
I had it.
I still have it. Yeah.
I mean, but that's very VLC. Everything under the sun.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You got a laser disc? We got you covered.
Hey, we talked about YouTube TV earlier, and one of its competitors is Hulu. And
I finally canceled my Hulu subscription this week. Finally.
Wow.
I mean, like, the only thing holding me on to Hulu was my wife loves A Handmaid's Tale. So some of the original programming. But they had this incredibly poorly received UI update. Interface update maybe 4 months ago, and they spent a lot of advertising, and then they had an earnings update. There's $1 billion invested in Hulu last year from its various
investors.
Is that
content or platform or all of the above?
All of the above. This is garnered from filings from Comcast, which is one of the investors. So it wasn't like there was an earnings call where they took questions on this, but they also reported $920 million in losses.
Ooh. Dang.
I think we're at sort of death's door with Hulu.
Oh no.
Well, I think, like, what's its point? What's its relevancy anymore?
I mean,
well, for cord cutters, like it seems like it's betting on the future, because people who are I got to imagine that people are cutting cords more and more every year, and they're switching over to Hulu.
100%, but it doesn't have an identity anymore. It does live TV, it does original content, it does the next day content from major providers.
Yeah.
I don't think it can be all three of those things and do any of them great.
The next day is the thing that's that has its competitive advantage, because it has all this investment from your actual content owners, right? NBC and Comcast, and whereas Netflix, it's binging, you know, at the several months after end of the season. Here is where you're going to get this most recent season without having to wait for it to be on Netflix.
Which sounds great, but more and more shows aren't doing that, because either the network has decided to push their own platform, or the show, when it signs licensing deals or distribution deals, pulls that show off of Hulu as part of that deal. So like something like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. on ABC has a deal to syndicate their content on Netflix after the season ends.
Yeah.
Well, now that content isn't on Hulu anymore, even though Hulu still has a deal with ABC where it broadcasts. So I think its relevance is going away.
And you think the original content strategy is not paying off?
I know. Handmaid's Tale. Tell me what else.
Transparent's
good. No, that's Amazon.
Whoops. Brand problem.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, that's the thing. One show does not a network make.
Yeah. Yeah. At that scale, at least. And Amazon, actually, I think, is doing really well in terms of with Marvelous Miss Maisel and Grand Tour, actually producing content that people want to pay to see.
You know, you can stream every season of Whose Line Is It Anyway for free on CWSeed.com. Didn't know that till recently. That's good info, though. If you're looking for funny, that's good info.
Holds up.
Yeah, it does.
Totally holds up. And we have one last story in tech.
Yeah, we're finally getting some integration between Amazon and Whole Foods, which, like, all we've really seen is, like, Amazon Fresh storage lockers, like, some promise of Amazon products being sold at Whole Foods. Well, now you can get Whole Foods delivered via Prime Now.
Well, not everywhere.
Not everywhere, in select markets, right, to start.
Yeah.
Bay Area.
But I do like this idea of, I mean, Amazon's in the delivery business. Oh, we didn't even talk about this huge story from Amazon. They announced, what is it, Ship to You? What's it called? They announced a building out a competitor to UPS and FedEx.
Oh, yes, that's right.
I don't know about that. Tell me about this. This is important.
Ship Anywhere, I think, is what it's called. It's basically they're doing, at least to start with, for businesses, the idea you can ship through an Amazon service. They will come out, pick up your package, and deliver.
So this is not delivered, because they've always had, you know, their paid for supplement to UPS and
their first
FedEx.
Party delivery guys.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Who aren't very good. I don't know if you've had an experience.
Okay.
No, never good.
Like, I will tell you one thing that got better.
But they're the people that are supposed to go in your house.
Yeah. One thing that got better is I got an Amazon package deliver and I hit the tracking info. Now they include a picture of where they left the package.
Interesting.
That was new.
Great.
Doesn't change Jeremy's mind.
Do they have a picture
continue.
Of the guy stealing it 10 seconds after they leave it?
Yeah. That's on you. But yes, they haven't been in this business of, they have been in the business of the final leg of delivery. But now the shipping part, I think that's interesting for small businesses. Now it's a new competitor. UPS's stock has sort of cratered under this news.
Really?
Yeah, it's down like 3%. I mean, that's not a stock that's going to go down 10%.
Yeah.
As a giant company, but it's down like 2 or 3% on this news.
Crater's a big word.
Well, I mean, it is a pretty big decline. I think what's interesting is Amazon's all about these low margin plays, like 2% or something. Are they going to start exerting pressure on FedEx and UPS in that way? I think this is potentially great for small businesses.
Is it only business right now?
I believe it's only business is what they announced.
I mean, so much of this works on the literal backs of the people who are doing the day-to-day, making the packaging, the packages, doing the deliveries, and to make it more competitive so that they cut either service or quality of service or benefits to these people, I think sucks. I think race to the bottom for delivery. I mean, let the drones do it. That's fine, because the drones don't care. But, you know, we like our delivery people, and it's an undervalued service.
Yes.
And to just have that be assumed as a commodity is not something where I want to see this going.
Fair. The business practices around it, like we've heard stories about, you know, delivery people having to like pee in bottles to make their quota for the day, and all sorts of stuff like that. I think some competition in this marketplace that's been dominated by two players for decades is not a bad thing.
Don't forget good old USPS.
Oh, sure.
They're good too.
Yeah. But it's different. They can't exert the same sort of competitive price pressure.
All right.
Want to say that I do appreciate my UPS driver. And I would love to be able to choose UPS when I buy something from Amazon. Mm. I would pay more as a prime customer to choose the shipping method.
You would pay more but not delay your shipping.
No, exactly. No, like if it's going to cost me an extra buck to do UPS instead of the first party Amazon delivery guy, I will choose that and happily pay that dollar.
Why doesn't Amazon, I mean, I know why, but like, wouldn't it be cool if Amazon allowed you to tip ahead of time?
Tip?
With that?
Tip.
Tip your driver through your purchase?
You tip your driver?
You should tip your, I mean, like, you know, you get them present at the every year.
Wow. That's true.
I do stuff at Christmas, but Patreon for my UPS driver? Here we go.
Bring it.
Right, have it built into the delivery mechanism. You know, would you like to tip your driver?
You're confusing the matter. I want to pay.
You want to pay
to choose. Okay,
give them more work. They're just going to get more work, but they're not going to get any paid anymore. Before we move to our next segment, I want to thank the sponsor of this week's episode, and that's Google Cloud Platform. What can your data tell you? With Google's Cloud Platform, use machine learning at scale to build better products. Google Cloud's AI provides modern machine learning services with pre-trained models and a service to generate your own tailored models. Their platform is now available as a cloud service to bring unmatched scale and speed to your business applications, and it predicts so your business can thrive. To learn more about Google's Cloud Platform, go to g.co/getcloudai and thank them for sponsoring this week's episode.
Now it's time for a moment of science. So the president's science budget came out this week, and it's important to note there's a couple changes from what we have been hearing. One is that there had been drastic cuts, about 30% cuts to the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation, which mostly fund basic research proposed, but essentially they get eliminated in the final budget. So they were spared. NASA's budget included cutting all funding to the International Space Station, which had some planned obsolescence. It also cut five different missions that were designed to observe the Earth. Because those missions are related to climate change. This includes a 40% cut to the EPA, a 35% cut to the National Oceanic Administration, all related to climate change. So the EPA would go back to funding levels in circa 1990. The Office of Education at NASA would be eliminated as part of this as well. Now, we should just say, like, presidential budgets aren't usually final budgets. Congress approves the final budget. But this really sets the roadmap. The only thing I think of real note here is, you know, obviously I'm a proponent for more funding of basic science research, and that's largely preserved here. I'm concerned about the targeted selection towards climate change in this budget. It's not a surprise. But I think it represents some meddling with where the science wants to go versus what some political goals of the administration. So I'm disappointed in that. And I don't really want to see our commitment to the ISS end. And that also canceled a new telescope, which would be the follow-up to the James Webb telescope, which is the successor to the Hubble telescope. More on that as it develops, but as we are the largest investor as a government into science of any nation in the world, I think this sets a global agenda. So this will be interesting to follow. All right.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Now, I wonder about this. Is when people who are at the top of government, you think generally well-educated people, and they're against climate, they don't believe in climate change publicly. Is this true? Do they not believe that this is a real, genuine threat? Or do they just follow the money and they feel that the old industries are more profitable and so that they publicly take this stance?
So I can only comment to a private conversation I had once around this, but you know, I'm not having, you know, whiskeys with congressional leaders in D.C., but
why not?
Because I live in San Francisco and I'm a coastal elite. I interviewed Bill Nye last year in September, and they had just announced who they were going to nominate to head NASA. This guy, Jim Bridenstine, who used to be a congressman from Oklahoma, no background in space science. Publicly, very much against climate change and any policy that pushes climate change forward. But Bill told me that he thinks Jim actually does support the science behind the scenes, but doesn't publicly support climate change in front of the scenes. Take that for what it's worth. I mean, it's no shock that a politician believes one thing and says something else. You know, I don't think we're surprised by that. I suspect a lot of politicians fall into that boat. Climate change doesn't poll well. It doesn't poll high on a priority list for voters, so I'm not shocked that you could have this argument against it. And if your number one thing is to reduce the size of government, reduce financial spending of the government in areas that you don't like, this is one area to cut that is going to go over well with a certain part of the population.
Okay.
Anyways, let's go from politicians to cockroaches. Okay. I know, tough walk here. Mm-hmm. Most robots that we've ever seen developed are all about obstacle avoidance or understanding a hurdle so that they can overcome it. Well, a new set of researchers have designed a robot that mimics cockroach behavior. And this is not a new thing. Cockroaches are amazing, hardy creatures that can squeeze into small spaces, that can transform some of their biology in a way to get to places that you normally wouldn't expect. But they approach this robot design in a different way. Under high speed, you can see cockroaches as they're approaching like a wall. Mm-hmm. They just run straight into it sometimes.
Okay.
And when they do, they seem to climb up the wall, which is amazing because they don't really have like the biology to climb objects like that.
How do they do it?
Like they don't have like stickers on their arms.
Right.
And so they built a robot to mimic this behavior, this incredibly lightweight robot. And it had the same sort of propeller mechanism as a cockroach, this sort of winding legs that were sort of spinning really fast as it approached this thing, and had the robot just run into walls.
Cool.
And it was able to climb the wall. It used its momentum and its lightweight ability, and it created like a little bit of low pressure in front of it as it was going it with enough speed to create propulsion up the wall. Not all the way up.
Right, right.
Like, you know, in terms of its like body size, it was able to get its entire body up against the wall and, you know, not climb very much or very high, but to go full vertical, and something we can't do, I can't do.
Mm-hmm.
The American Ninja Warrior contestants are like, I got this. but it's sort of amazing, like, to think about that. I thought what's fascinating about it is we've been thinking about everything is obstacle avoidance, as opposed of using those obstacles as leverage
mm-hmm.
to a destination. And I think that's an interesting development in robotics.
But it's in relation to its speed and weight, then.
Yes, it has to be super lightweight, moving pretty fast, and have this like unique propulsion system.
So you're saying an alternative to the drone avoiding the tree is just learning how to crash into it better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And leveraging that crash to bump and go around it. All right, do you guys have the show notes up? Because I have two things to show you.
Yeah, dude.
Do you remember my friend, the parrot, that had the aviator goggles from last year?
Yes.
That went through the laser field?
Yes.
Well, I have a new friend to introduce you to.
Ooh.
It's a praying mantis.
With aviator goggles.
No, better. This is full VR. We've never, always thought that stereo vision was something that developed purely in mammals.
This is amazing.
So, in order to understand how stereoscopic development actually occurs, a group of researchers basically 3D printed 3D glasses for a praying mantis and then developed films that would be played in front of the praying mantis showing the movement of prey in front of them to see if they could actually see in 3D.
Uh-huh.
So, and yes, they can see.
But they see in color. So that's the only reason this anaglyph would work.
Sort of. They don't really see in color. And they don't see 3D in the way we see 3D, which is this sort of like, you know, static shape. They see movement more.
I guess it doesn't matter if they see in color because the lenses are just masking left and right in stereo. So it could still be grayscale. But yeah, that is a photo of a mantis wearing an anaglyph lenses.
We got to get this into the projections intro.
Dude, is it video where it's just like head turning? It's like...
It's just awesome. I also like what I think is hilarious is there's a grad student out there, and I got to find the quote, but basically he's like, I spent months creating movies for praying mantises to watch in 3D.
Oh, dude, that's awesome.
Which is, I think, pretty amazing. One last picture in the show notes if you have up. There's a picture there of this like kind of like particle trap, if you guys can see it.
Yeah, dude.
There's something at the center of that. Can you see a little dot at the center? And I'll put this in the show notes for the listeners. There's a visible thing in between those two detectors, if you kind of enlarge it. Can you see it?
No, it just looks like black emptiness.
If you look really closely, maybe Norm has the Pixel book. Maybe he has enough resolution to see it.
I can pinch and zoom.
Yeah, pinch and zoom.
There's a white dot.
Yeah, that is a single atom.
What?
That can't be.
Surrounded by in a sphere of air?
No, that is a single atom.
Magnified.
In a vacuum. Like, obviously, this picture is magnified, but not magnified as much as you think. This won a picture contest for best science image, and they had trapped a strontium atom, I believe, in this area. And the funny thing about the strontium atom is that it picks up some of the light that's available, the UV light, and reabsorbs it as visible light. And that's why we can actually see it. But that is a single atom.
Oh, so the sphere of light is bigger than a single atom.
It is.
That's interesting.
But that is one atom.
Emitting.
Mm-hmm.
That's neat.
And we can...
Reflecting.
Yeah. Reflecting light. I think that's one of the coolest pictures I've ever seen. I've never seen a single atom before.
I want to see scale for the rest of the stuff around it.
A banana?
Yeah.
I need a banana here because this, I imagine all that other stuff is pretty minuscule too.
We need a different measure of scale for tiny things.
I think you can see some bolts in there that are standard size bolts.
Standard size bolts?
Well, I mean, they're like nuts. I mean,
you know, M10s, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
You really, yeah, M10s. We'll call them that.
Damn, then that sphere of light is much bigger than an atom.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's it for this week.
Oh, that's all you got? All right, that's a good science week.
The VR Minute, virtual reality this week.
It might actually only be a minute.
I know, we got very few things to talk about. First of all, how about something tangential related to VR? Ready Player One, we got a new poster.
What do you think? I hated the last poster.
You mean the one with the leg that was like three of him long?
Yeah, long leg. That was weird, man. What
this
were they
new poster definitely evokes a Spielbergian vibe to it. It actually it's done by the artist who did Force Awakens, I believe, right?
Or The Last Jedi, at least.
Or Last Jedi. Yeah, yeah. It's painted. It's not a photo, but yeah. It's a very it's painterly in the same way that Drew Struzan's poster art was, so definitely evoking that 80s vibe.
Every character in a montage.
Yep, yep. A stacking of heads. And we have our first looks at some of the other characters, the brothers.
Daito and, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm going full blackout. Just because I think the promotion for this movie has looked terrible, that I need to maintain those low expectations.
I didn't realize, I guess Bigfoot was in the trailer, but I didn't realize it was H's car. So I guess H drives Bigfoot.
I guess if you don't know the story, there are some spoilers in terms of the character reveals right on the poster.
What do you mean?
Like who's, I mean...
Not looking.
Yeah, never mind.
See, I've been waiting for this poster, though, because I didn't like the last one. I was thinking it'd be a good poster to hang in my above my computer museum where I have like my original PC Junior, my first 486, all running.
Mm-hmm.
This would be great to hang above that. So this is the one.
So you're going to wait and see the movie first? Because what if it's terrible?
Yeah, you know, it can always be like of the book. I know I like the book, so there's the poster the movie for the book. So I don't know. The only thing is, will Mondo make a better one?
Oh, I'm sure there'll be a bunch.
I hope so.
I don't know which artists they tap into.
Let me know if you hear about that.
All right. The other thing we want to talk about in the VR Minute is Magic Leap. Some Magic Leap news. The CEO of Magic Leap, Roni, made an interview appearance at the Recode conference and sat with Carl Swisher to talk about, well, their launch plans.
Yeah, I think there's a couple bits of news that came out of this. One is that they're still committed to launching this year, and didn't say when, but sometime this year, quote unquote. But I took it to mean that they are definitely going to come out this year. Indicated some price indication. Said, you know, kind of vaguely that it was going to be the cost of a high-end cell phone tablet, mm-hmm. which to me says like $1,000 to $1,500 in terms of what it'll cost. Indicated there'll be different sizes for the actual glasses, so you can order like a small, medium, large kind of type.
Is that, you think, for comfort, or will they have different field of views?
I think it's comfort.
Okay.
The way that it was described, it sort of struck me as comfort and fit. And then they announced some content partnerships.
Okay.
And I recognized one of the faces sitting with him. It was Adam Silver, who's the commissioner of the NBA, which is not who I would expect to be first up. And they trotted out, via video, Shaquille O'Neal wearing Magic Leap.
Shaq has worn Magic Leap.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if like Shaq was like some sort of like early investor. But the idea, and he was like, Roni was really, really guarded about saying anything that this is augmented reality. He was like, this is definitely mixed reality. This is an AR. I still think what they're talking about with the NBA is a version of AR where you get to watch the game, but you can sort of control. I think the most interesting part is you can watch a game and there's some overlaid information on top of that game, which is totally what we want.
You mean watch the game in the stadium, be there, or watch it on TV?
I think he's talking about not in the stadium.
Oh, okay.
Maybe I was wrong. Maybe I misunderstood that. That's... But he talked about being able to, within the glasses, like pin a screen like we do in like virtual desktop.
Yeah.
Okay. Where it's playing, mm-hmm. which is like mixed reality, I guess. Like that's not AR anymore.
Yeah, implementation is going to be really interesting. And I think
I couldn't picture what they were talking about.
Much smarter of them to aim for a use case where you're in the home, where this replaces your second screen. You're not looking down to look at a phone or a laptop. You are still looking at their big screen. Then have this be an implementation in sports arenas at the moment.
What do you think? $1,000?
Yeah, like, price point. I mean, they haven't said exactly $1,000, but you know, a high end smartphone.
Let's imagine. Yeah,
it's a first gen product. I think that's totally valid.
I mean, are you in? Would you buy this?
I got to try it first.
Would you want to watch sports this way? Where like this area in front of our podcast table here, you could just watch a game and see, you know,
a flat screen on the table, or
no, TV? Like you're watching TV, except it's out here with light field, and it would be more 3D.
Oh.
That's what Shaq talked about.
Light field capture. Yes.
That he watched, Orlando versus Cleveland game, an actual game that was played right next to him.
Totally.
He's talking about two-dimensional.
No, he's talking about three-dimensional, light field capture.
Like little tiny people?
Mm-hmm. They're still 7 feet tall. 6'13".
All right, so
Shaq isn't the greatest like descriptor of what this technology looks like, and I think when it comes down to it, like all these fancy descriptions that the company has won't mean anything until we try it ourselves.
These be in Best Buys like the Rift has been?
Depends on scale of production.
I think, like you said,
$1,000 is yes, I would assume yes.
People have to try it.
Yeah, I think they got to get the demo kiosk and the implementation.
Here's one thing that was hinted at that I think we should talk about is that he hinted at that they weren't going to be a one product company, that they were going to have multiple SKUs, like a pro version and a, you know, elite version.
What would that change?
I don't know. What would that was my question too,
right? If the lenses are the lenses, right? And like, I would hate for them to say wider field of view, smaller field of view, with the price tiers. I don't think that's it. So maybe computing power,
controllers.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very easy way to say to differentiate between the SKUs, input method, because AR is powerful without having without motion controls.
As long as the gestures are good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I still don't know how they're going to sell this product. Like what you're saying. Like, do you have to try it on? And that's basically it.
I think you try it on, you get a compelling demo, and that's going to sell people. Especially if it's not an accessory. It looks like, right? It's not going to be tethered to your phone. The computing comes on board. It's all inclusive, whether it's on a your belt pack or whatever. So $1,000, I don't think is completely unreasonable to be an early adopter if they have invested a lot in content already.
Well, if you get the follow drone and we get two Magic Leaps, we'll be in it for about the same amount of money.
That's right.
And then again, I mean, if you get reviewers saying this is it, mm-hmm. we've been waiting for this augmented reality, we love it, people are going to buy it sight unseen.
No.
Yeah, I bet they will. Thousand. I mean, not enough to for them to go in the green, but or black, but I think a lot of early adopters will buy this sight unseen.
The bigger problem that they have, because their early adopters are going to be the people who are they're selling to are going to be the early adopters, is the same problem that Skydio may have, is that does it feel like a first gen product, where does it feel like the iPhone versus 3GS, where they can scale up and iPhone was not perfect 2007, or does it feel like a Tesla Model S high end, which will always be the high end before they get to the Model 3? They want it to be the latter, where this feels like the premium product at launch for early adopters, for emerging technology, but it's not going to be outdated. The Model S isn't outdated. It's still best in breed, but they can then lower the price point and get a different version as battery life improves or something later on. They want that as opposed to something that's going to feel outdated in 2 years.
Testing this week. Hey, what have you guys been testing?
Oh, a couple things. Adafruit started selling a thermal camera last year, which is neat. It's a tiny little sensor that is an 8x8 thermal sensor. So you get these 64 squares, essentially. You get 64 values of thermal, of temperature right in front of the camera. And it measures, several feet away. So you can hook this up to any display and just have it read this data. Like every data is a piece of data is maybe like 8 bits. You turn it into a color value and you've got this thermal image, and then you can resample it. So I played a bit with that. It's super easy. You just read it over I squared C, and you whatever display you've got. So what are these? They make these tiny little Arduino displays that have their own processors on the back. Tiny Duino, I think, is the tiny circuits.
Tiny Duino is their product line.
Okay, Tiny Circuits is the company.
Yep.
So I hooked it up to that, which I don't think anybody else had tried before. Tiny little thing connected to this thermal sensor, resampling it to whatever, like 4 times as many pixels. It was fun. It's totally fun to get it. The frame rate's not the best, but you get this cool little thermal image. It's feels like Terminator or Predator. It was fun. Mm-hmm. I tested that. $40 chip.
Not bad. Go ahead.
I also turned the game frame into a stock ticker.
Real-time data?
Real-time data. It was originally just Bitcoin, and then I thought, everyone's going to want to try. Not everybody cares about Bitcoin.
Sure.
And so,
why shouldn't they?
The millions of game frame owners out there will want Apple stock and Microsoft.
What a time when the Dow is down 3,000 points in the last couple of weeks for you to...
How is that scale?
Turn on this.
You get interesting charts that
way. Is it percentage-wise or is it numerically? What's your...
Well, you set the duration so you can have 1 minute, 5 minute, up to an hour or a day per column. You got 16 columns. And then it's just, whatever you want. You plug in your stock and it charts it out. You have a regular line graph or candlesticks. So you can see how much green and red you've got throughout the past 16 days. And it's fun. It's kind of cool. I mean, it's not something that you would use to trade by, but it's a cool little feature. I enjoy having it on my game frame. I'll release that code as soon as it's ready.
I have a new dapping set that I'm using for my Infinity Gauntlet. I might have mentioned
that move people do, right?
Sort of. My move looks a little different. It looks more like this.
Oh yeah.
It's just a hammer and shaping set because I'm hand shaping my Infinity Gauntlet out of brass, and it's been really interesting to get different tools for this purpose.
All right,
I'm using the pickleball, Pixel book.
It has that same like glass on top as the old Pixel phone.
Oh, you're actually using it right now.
I've been using it the whole time.
Unbelievable.
With a twist.
Unbelievable.
It was a Pixel book the whole time.
What do you think?
The Android apps are funky on it. Not everything performs exactly as I expected it would on Android. The touchscreen's fine. Actually, I'm total convert, as I've been for years, on laptops with touchscreens. So really, for me, how's it compared to something like a Surface Pro? And I don't know yet. Performance is great, but I'll be testing it mostly for photos because there's Lightroom Mobile, which I use on my phone all the time. And if Lightroom and Mobile can work well as a on here as a road computer, then it's easier to carry this around with long battery life than it is to carry like a Surface Pro.
All right. I guess we'll be getting a longer video at some point.
Yes.
With your
absolutely.
Thoughts.
I've only had it for 3 days.
Right. What's coming up on Tested real quick?
On Tested, we are wrapping up. I think we have 2 more weeks of Aardman videos. Early Man does also come out this weekend. Want to give a shout out to that. You guys should absolutely watch the video I did with the Skydio folks. And you'll have an episode of Projections tomorrow, I think, in which Jeremy and I visited a company that does high-quality, high-resolution photogrammetry and has ported much of their photogrammetry to VR.
Mm-hmm.
For a release this week, Masterworks VR.
Most importantly, when can people watch the boat video?
Probably in a week or a week and a half.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bated breath.
Yeah. That does it for This Is Only a Test this week. As I mentioned off the top, thank you out there, dedicated listeners, including those. You guys know who I'm talking about. And if you don't think I'm talking about you, I am. Thank you for listening once again, and we have an outro this week.
Yes, thanks again, Justin, a.k.a.
Seed.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
Tested. The average length of time it takes a mammal to empty their bladder is 23 seconds, from the tiniest mouse up to the largest whale.
I did not know that.
23 seconds.
Wow, did you learn that on Planet Earth too? And I'd already forgotten it until I heard it just now.
I have to pee now. I'm going to time myself.
All right, here we go. Mammal.
See ya.